Fans, we are back live with another edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. My name is Jack Kilby, Executive Vice President of Great North Wrestling, and we're here today with a very special guest, a man who has had a lengthy, noteworthy, and illustrious career in the professional wrestling business. He had a very, very successful tenure as the ring announcer for World Championship Wrestling and also for Total Nonstop Action Wrestling. And he's just released a book that's getting a lot of attention, and it's entitled Sitting Ringside Volume 1. And I would be talking about none other than Mr. David Penzer. David, welcome to the show today, sir.
Hey, guy, how are you? Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. But before we get into the questions, as per the tradition, I must introduce Mr. Cheap Heat himself, a pending public servant, a man of the people, a hardworking lad by the name of Morris Shorthall. Morris, welcome to your own show again.
Thanks very much, Jack. And really, really appreciate having David here today. Thanks so much for your time, man.
Sure, man. Happy to do it.
Well, David, I guess I would start off with the obvious question, and that would be, what at this stage of your career and all the notable events in your career, what was it about the era at present that made you decide to write your book?
I had absolutely no inclination nor desire a year ago to write a book about myself. When my, was with Impact before I finished up at the end of last year, people would ask me, that fans would say, hey, you gonna put out a book? Absolutely not. No interest, not gonna do it. Well, I was cleaning out my desk one day and I found all these old, rare, never before seen WCW formats. Stuff from 30 years ago, WCW Saturday Night formats, the last Nitro format that's never been made public for whatever reason. It blows my mind. The format where David Arquette won the world title. And I didn't know what to do with it, but I know people love to see how the sausage is made. And this shows you how the sausage is made, so to speak. So I took a picture of one of the Saturday Night formats, and I'm like, obviously I wanted to monetize it. The real estate business was not exactly, exploding back at the time. So, if I could make a little money here and get these out. So I put a picture and I just put on Twitter, like, who would want this? And, what do you think of the value of it? I have like 200 pages worth. And so different people said different things. And then Guy Evans sent me a DM and said, let's talk tomorrow. And he gave me his number. I had already spoken to him about the Nitro book. And he said, we should do a scrapbook. You could tell some stories about your memories of the matches and the formats. And I said, that sounds wonderful. So we started to do that. And I started to tell him my story. And about 3 months in, he goes, we're not doing a scrapbook. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, we're still going to have the formats in there, but I wanted to tell your story. Your story is fascinating. And I said, I don't know. And I said, I still think people are probably going to buy it for the formats. He's like, that's okay. Even if they buy it for the formats, which is totally cool if you want to do that. Hopefully they'll get around to reading your story because it's very interesting and your perspective is very interesting, blah, blah, blah. And I said, all right, well, I know you're a great writer, so let's do it. And so from not having any desire to write a biography, Guy convinced me that was the way to go. And here we are in May of 2024. I have an autobiography out and a scrapbook.
Excellent.
Can you talk to me then about the process of you and Guy working together on this project, David, and what way did it work for you?
Well, for me, it's easy. I like telling stories. I could talk about myself all day. But more than that, I could talk about the wrestling business. I'm so blessed to have gotten my pinky toe in that door that back in the days that we're talking about, the late 80s, early 90s, you just didn't get in if you weren't a wrestler or a referee. So I was very lucky. I worked very hard, and and I enjoyed every minute of it. When I was 11 years old, I turned on Championship Wrestling from Florida in May of 1977, and my life was changed. I fell in love and was mesmerized by this thing called professional wrestling. And nothing's changed since then, other than the fact that I got to be a part of it, and I got to see a lot of really cool things and meet a lot of really cool people who, you know, were people I watched on TV who now I call friends. So, to answer your question, sorry, I get off on tangents. To answer your question is, call, he'd press play on the microphone. He'd have some questions and we'd talk for an hour or two. And we did that pretty much day or night for about a month or two. And, I had no idea what he was going to do with the book. You know, when he first got it done, we got a rough draft to make the final changes. He would email me like a chapter at a time. And I was like, oh, my God, this is really cool. I can't wait for chapter two. This is my own story, but it's guided in a way that's much more entertaining than I could ever tell it, because Guy is a great book writer. It was amazing. And it was, like I said, it's easy for me. I like telling stories about and talking about the wrestling business. So you didn't have to hold a gun to my head to get me to engage in that.
David, I wanted to get your thoughts on why it seems that there is such a nostalgia for, of which full confession, I count myself as being one of them, for WCW. Notwithstanding the fact that it went through several incarnations in your career in terms of management and bookers, et cetera. But do you ever wonder why it is that the fans still look back on WCW from the early 90s through to when it closed in such a nostalgic manner? Because I know you meet fans and fan fests, et cetera, and you must get that a lot.
I think that, quite frankly, I think it's just because it never got its proper end. It never got its proper send off. And, people don't like that. There was a show called Manifest on network television. I don't know if you remember it. I was, it was about a plane that had gone missing, and all of a sudden everybody came back like 20 years later, the same age as they were. And anyways, so they were telling a story, and then they just canceled it. And everybody was up in arms. So eventually, after like tons of people, signing petitions and stuff, Hulu finished it. And people like this end of the story that they're invested in. These people invested their money, their time, their emotions in World Championship Wrestling. And then, with the snap of the finger, it went away and never to be really resurrected again. And I think that the human nature is so such that you don't want something taken away that you've invested so much time and energy in that quick. If we would have had 6 months to wrap it up, maybe it wouldn't have been such a big deal. But we had like a day and a half. So that wasn't really not.
David, for people watching this or listening to this that may not be aware, and without giving any spoilers away in the book, could you summarize how you came to work in WCW initially?
Yeah. I had loved wrestling, like I said, and, never really thought about doing it, getting in it, because it was such a closed business back then. And just out of nowhere, there's this company started called Global Wrestling Alliance. It was 1986 on the penny stock market, which no longer exists for a reason. And they raised like $500,000, and they wanted to, be a player in the ever-growing WrestleMania, Hulkamania wrestling business that was, turning from a regional territories to an international sensation. And it just so happened that the guy that ran it was a guy who wrestled under the name Dr. Red Roberts. His name was Dr. Michael Brand, and he was a psychologist. And my dad was a psychologist and owned a counseling center in the same city. And one of my dad's counselors, I don't know how it came up, but happened to be, you know, hey, I heard your son really loves wrestling. I have a friend and coworker who is now running a wrestling company, you know, and my dad would have probably said, oh, you know, if you could open any doors, that would be great. And so they invited me to a set of tapings at the Diplomat Hotel. I didn't go in the dressing room, but I was backstage. I didn't really know anybody at the time. So, you know, I just took it in sort of from a different perspective. And I started, they had an office with a school in the back. The teacher was Larry Malenko and the booker was Bob Roop. And started talking to them. And, you know, first I was just a stooge, you know, it's like, hey, you know, could I get you a cup of coffee? Or, you know, do you want me to take the garbage out? Or, you know, I was too young, but, you know, if I could, you know, could I get you a pack of beer? You know, and nobody's going to really, you know, if somebody's there to help and they're not being a mark and bothering you and asking you a ton of questions, nobody's going to really, in that environment, obviously you can't go into the WWE and do that, but in this small little environment, they're not going to turn that away. So eventually I kept going back and Larry Malenko, the great Malenko, just got curious. He's like, hey, come in my office and sit down. What are you doing here? And I'm like, well, I'd like to be a ring announcer. I love this business. And he saw the passion, gave me a lot of tips, and we became friends. And then me and Bob Roop became friends. Long story short, the company went out of business. Me and Bob bought the ring. We went up and down the Southern Florida running indie shows. He the business, took me under his wing. He got a call one day to go to WCW to be an agent under Ole Anderson, who he was tight with. I said, hey, yeah, give a good word for me. Never thinking he would, because he shouldn't have, because if I would have, disaster, he could have gotten fired from it by it. Because back in the day, everybody just kept their mouth shut. Nobody said, hey, I saw this guy and I know this guy, you know, you didn't want to get heat. But he did. God bless him. And I started jiving enhancement up and working with Jody Hamilton doing that and, you know, stooging around even more. We thought about naming the book Stooge of the Year. you know, I started doing tasks nobody wanted to do, running guys for Jim Ross for interviews, you know, walking around with a sign-in sheet. You know, getting the enhancement guys information so they could get paid, you know, their tax ID and stuff, ringing the bell. And, you know, I just kind of stuck. It was quite a miracle. I always used to ask Jody, he passed, God bless him. But I used to tell Jody, you saw something in me that wasn't there. But he saw something. He said it was passion. And I think passion's driven a lot of my success as business. There's something about passion that if you see it, and you love the wrestling business too, because almost anybody that's in this business obviously loves it, or else they wouldn't be driving up and down the roads, especially in the territory days like they were. So I think that people could smell the passion and the passion. And I think that makes people do things that maybe the back of their mind says, yeah, you know, he's not a wrestler. He probably shouldn't be here, but he seems to be a nice guy. So I'll keep bringing him back. And I mentioned to somebody, hey, I could ring announce, I could talk on a mic, and the backup bringing down that fired, and I had a tryout, and I like to say I won by default because I was coming up anyway, but thus my journey embarked, and just incredible. And we go into a lot further detail into all that in the book. That's the cliff notes for sure, but it's just amazing. You know, I so many things had to go right. I call it my improbable, near impossible journey into pro wrestling.
You were there during the heyday of one of the greatest tag teams in the world and forever, and that would be the Steiner Brothers. And a fan on social media wanted to know if there were any if you had any Steiner Brothers bullying stories or whatever you want to call it from back in the day that we've heard so much about from Rick and Scott.
Well, I mean, in 2024, you call it bullying. Perhaps it was. I don't know. It was a very different world back then. There was no internet. There were no cell phones for the most part. You know, Paul Heyman had this big one that he walked around with, but there were no cell phones. So we had to do stuff to entertain ourselves. And, you know, especially on long drives or in the long days of TV tapings. And, you know, that was ribbon. It's a long, long standing, thing in the pro wrestling business that you, you know, rib guys. And, you know, most of it's not cruel natured, you know. You know, I remember one time there was this guy, this enhancement wrestler who was mouthing off the Steiners. We happened to be in Chattanooga at on campus, and the dressing room was the actual wrestling, like, practice room. And they had a rope hanging from the top of the ceiling. I guess people would walk, you know, go up and down the rope to gain strength. And so the Steiners taped him to the rope and said, the person who takes him down is the next one that tapes that we tape up. And he was up there for about an hour. I mean, I don't know if you'd call that bullying. He thought the enhancement guy was thought it was the coolest thing in the world. So, you know, but Janie Engel, who was a longtime Crockett assistant, and eventually was Eric Bischoff's assistant during the heyday, she ended up taking him down because she, you know, nobody would have put Janie Engel up on a rope. That's immediate terms for getting fired. So, but it's stuff like that, you know, so you could say good natured, you know, some of it wasn't as good natured, but, you know, it just was what it was. I guess you didn't really think about it. You didn't think about it and say, you know, I'm going to call, you know, the newspaper and report this and, you know, or go on social media and complain, you know, that I was, you know, it just wasn't such a thing. You just went to the next town. Mm. By the way, and I'm not excusing it. I'm just explaining it.
Yeah, well, I totally understand what you're saying.
It's interesting that, that some of the folks in the business that were quote unquote bullied by the Steiners also didn't consider it bullying. And I'm thinking of a guy like the Disco Inferno, who apparently got it quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Disco was a heat mag. You know, there's two ways to go about yourself. You could, you know, kind of lay low and not, you know, bring any attraction to yourself, or you could, you know, talk crap and, you know, be a wise ass. And, you know, I took the former and I pretty much went unscathed. I mean, I got ribbed for sure. There was a time that every time that I got back to a locker room, my briefcase was locked, padlocked to something in the locker room. It was always something different. And, the ring crew had putting bolt cutters in the ring truck just to get it off. So and that was Kurt Hennig and Nick Patrick and a couple other people that I'm not sure about. But you know, you just don't sell it. You just say, nice place. I didn't know who was doing it at the time, but I had a feeling. But you know, go in the locker room, all the guys would be back there, and I'd say, oh, you got whoever's doing this found a nice place to put it up. You know, did they still put it up the next night? Yeah. But they didn't, like, you know, do anything that was, you know, you were considered bullying. It was just rib. Disco took an opposite approach. He still does, you know. And I think, you know, I think he liked the attention, even if it was negative attention. I've been with him and Arn Anderson a couple of times where I just poked and prodded Arn to the point where Arn was legitimately mad. And Arn didn't get legitimately mad very often. You know, he's a laid back guy. So I think he likes to bring that out in people. And I think he expects that at some point they're going to be a reaction. I was walking down San Antonio with Keith Mitchell, our production director, and a couple of production assistants, and Scott Hall. Scott Hall was dating one of the production assistants. And we were walking to a bar in San Antonio after match. And I got blue jeans and cowboy boots, and I didn't have a hat. But Scott Hall said, I said something out, and Scott Hall said, if you say that again, I'm going to push you in the water, because, you know, there's a river all around San Antonio. And Scott said, you don't have a hair on your ass. And I knew I was going in the water. I wasn't expecting anything different. I was just making a point for whatever reason. I was feeling ornery, and I just, you know, I was going to take I was going to the San Antonio River, and I knew it. And I wasn't mad. I didn't, you know, yell and scream. I said, all right, well, I deserve that, because I did. And I went back to my hotel room, and thank God I took a shower and had to put on new clothes and met him at the bar. And we all had a great time laughing about it. And people still ask me about it to this day. You know, to this day, when Keith Mitchell's in San Antonio, he takes a picture of the river and texts it to me. So, you know. Consciously, did I know why I was doing it? No. I was in the mood to push his buttons, and I knew I was going to get pushed in the water instead. So it's just, you know, it's wrestling. And I'm not, again, I'm not excusing it. I'm just explaining.
Can you hear us, David?
Yeah. Did I lose you?
I thought we lost you there for a second. No, we're all cool. One of the most memorable things that kind of popped up with people we were talking to when we told them you're having you on the show was your exchanges with Chris Jericho on WCW television. Can you explain what he was like to work with and what do you think of him still wrestling to this day?
Chris is great. I just sent him a book. He's a great, still a great friend. He lives around in my area, so I see him every once in a while. If he throws a party at his estate, and he was a good friend on the road, and he came up with this. He wanted to, you know, turn heel and get some attention and show a different side of his personality, and he came up with, I'd say 99% of it. I might have got a word in here or there. He'd probably say I didn't say a word and came up with all of it, which is probably true. If I was talking to Chris, I'd say, you know, let my ego say I came up with something, you know, he'd say no. And again, that's just the nature of, you know, people in the wrestling business who are just like to mess with each other. It's not like ill will. It's just like, you know, I've said with a smile and a laugh. He got it approved. Terry Taylor got it approved by Eric or Kevin, and we started doing it. And, you know, Chris, I'd say, you know, there's a lot of people who use the word GOAT, greatest of all time, and they throw that word around a lot. And I don't know if I could say who the greatest wrestler of all time is. I would say Terry Funk if I was pushed, but you could convince me probably otherwise because there's so many great wrestlers. But I would say Chris Jericho is the greatest of all time of reinventing himself successfully. I've never seen a wrestler in this business reinvent themselves so many times and draw money every time they did it, and so many different unique ways. And he would do these passive things that nobody would really understand, that nobody would really get, but he would do them just to add another layer. For example, after he would get beat, he would rip off my tuxedo jacket and he'd take my chair and he'd bang it on the ring post. Next week, he'd come out with a new tuxedo jacket and a chair. I'm sitting in a building with 5,000 chairs. There's no reason to bring me a chair. I was sitting on a chair before that segment started. But it was the little things like that. It's the clicking of the pen before you're on the list. I mean, that became something that people reacted to. And it's the little things that make him so brilliant. Love the guy. Huge talent. Super nice guy. And looking forward to being on Talk is Jericho after he finishes reading the book. That should be fun.
Awesome. Wanted to ask you, David, about your working relationship with Eric Bischoff from the perspective of when he took over the company and brought it to such great heights where WWE was being beaten to when things started to go south before he was out.
Well, you know, Eric's he was a unique personality, and he was under intense pressure, especially, you know, after the Monday Night War started. And so, you know, a lot of times you go to work, which at work was being at the arena, wherever we were, or even being at the office, because I had an office in Atlanta. And, you know, you want to go up to the boss. Hey, how you doing? How are the kids? You know, schmoozing, doozing. And I quickly realized that wasn't Eric Bischoff. Eric Bischoff, at least it's somebody at my level, you didn't speak to him unless he needed something. You know, I would still say hi and he'd say hey, but you know, it wouldn't be, you know, he wasn't the schmoozy type of person. He'd be the first person to admit it, and I'm sure he already has. So we never really had a lot of interaction, to be honest with you. I reported to Tony Schiavone and then Craig Leathers if there was an issue that had to go up to Eric. And I think there was only one that we talk about in the book. It's a pretty cool story that, Craig went to him on my behalf. And, You know, I learned that the secret in this business is just to lay low and don't bring any attention to yourself. The people in a large company like WCW or WWE, although I've never been WWE, if they're not talking about you and you're just doing your job and, you know, not causing any crap, you know, they basically don't think about you. And if they don't think about you, they can't let you go. They can't, you know, yell at you or reprimand you. So yeah, but you know, Eric and I have become friends and it was kind of cool. It's kind of lethargic, you know, to become friends with the guy who was your boss, who really didn't show you a lot of attention. I talk a lot about mental health in this book and anxiety, and Eric never gave me anxiety, but there's a part of wanting attention from your, you know, your father or your boss. And, you know, it's not his fault that he wasn't that type of person, but it was very lethargic when me and Eric got to sit down over a couple of drinks and became friends. And, you know, it was sort of a cool end to that story. And we're still friends to this day. I'm going to be on a conference call with him tomorrow morning.
Awesome. I've got a question for you, David. Were you in the building the night of the invasion angle where Triple H and crew drove up to WCW up to the arena?
Yeah, nobody's been that before in this round of interviews over the last few weeks. That's a great question. The answer is yes, and I had no idea they were out there. I don't know who did. I'm sure people did, but I had no idea that they were out there. I was shocked when I found out that they were out there afterwards. If it was my call, and it was like I was like probably the 180th person down on the list of who makes a call like that. But I don't let them in. You got Ming and Barbarian there. They ain't going to do anything. You know, we could have filmed it and made it, you know, made it so that they had to retreat, you know. So, but, you know, Eric made the call he thought was right. And 99% of the time, the calls Eric made, his gut was right. I don't know if he was wrong this time, but WWF at the time was able to play it up, certainly. And it was a little bit of a change in the war. But, I don't know that at the end of the day, that's, you know, what really changed was, in my opinion, was the Mike Tyson and Steve Austin. That was the angle that changed the interest. But, you know, I'd say, you know, the coming to Norfolk, Virginia at the Scope and yelling for us to come out and nobody coming out was probably, you know, it didn't hurt.
You were there, of course, during, you know, the Monday Night War, which we've already referenced, but, you know, the height of the healthiness, the mainstream nature of the wrestling business. We've heard a lot about WCW shooting itself in the foot, so to speak, with backstage politics. You know, we've heard about how allegedly Hogan and Nash and Hall, to a lesser extent, sort of took the steam out of Goldberg. From your perspective, did you see a lot of that sort of very, I'm not going to say toxic environment because it's 2024, but that very highly political nature where decisions were being made against the best interest of the company because of the players' stroke in the company?
Yeah, we talk about that extensively in the book too. And just as a brief overview, I would say that when things were going really well, it was more of a team atmosphere. There was always, you know, whenever there's guaranteed money involved, everybody's looking out for themselves, but it was more of a let's do this together. When things started going south, it was more looking after yourself. And I understand that. You know, that's human nature. You know, we talked about human nature here a couple of times. That's human nature. You know, there's millions of dollars a year involved. So, you know, for some of the top guys, so everybody was kind of jockeying to, you know, try to keep their spot or, you know, whatever. I wasn't too close to it. You know, you could sort of feel it happening, but you couldn't see it. It was all behind closed doors or on a phone for the most part. But yeah, certainly there was a lot of jockeying to keep people's spots and get more money. And I wouldn't call it toxic. It was definitely unhealthy though.
What's your thoughts, David, on Vince Russo and his contributions overall to the wrestling business? Because people always talk about the pros and the cons. Where do you sit on that?
I don't think he brought anything good to the wrestling business. We do a whole chapter on Vince Russo. Nothing personal. Vince is a nice guy. Hope his family is well. Hope he's doing well. Hope that he, you know, has all the success in the world. It's not a personal. I don't think he was a good wrestling writer ever. And that's my thoughts. Like I said, I go into it a lot more in the book. But to answer your question, I got no use for him as a wrestling writer. As a person, I talk with him. He probably wouldn't have me after what I wrote about him in the book, but he knows what I think. I had a podcast for 4 years. I wasn't shy about it. You know, not everybody likes everybody's style. You know, Brett Lauderdale is a friend of mine and a great wrestling player. But to me, he's the one who owns Game Changer Wrestling. To me, you bring a light bulb out in a match and break it, you've lost me. I got no interest. I watched Sting's match so anxiously, and when they brought the glass out and fell through the glass, they lost me. I watched it because I wanted to see the send-off, but they lost me as far as being excited about what I was watching. Doesn't mean it's bad. There's lots of people who pay a lot of money to go see that stuff. It just means I don't like it. I don't like Brett Lauderdale. Doesn't mean I don't like Sting or Darby Allin. It just means that it's not for me, and so I don't watch it. And you know, Vince Russo's stuff wasn't for me, but unfortunately, because I was there, I had to watch it. So it was frustrating. But again, there's so much tribalism in the business and with social media and all that, with the fans and all that. It's not really like that in real life. You know, there's like Jim Cornette and Vince Russo where they obviously really despise each other. But most people, you know, even if they had heat, it goes away, It very rarely does it last. And it does last sometimes. There's some things that people that can't forgive, but it rarely does it. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see, maybe 5 or 6 years from now to see CM Punk and the Young Bucks in a ring together. They should have done business, actually. And I think CM Punk wanted to. Nothing against the Bucks. Everybody deals with stuff different ways. I don't know what happened back then. So I can't, you know, say what should have been done or whatnot, but 9 out of 10 times that kind of stuff ends up as an angle down the road and everybody kind of forgets about how nasty it got. And, life's sort of like that, you know, like when I left WCW, I had so many negative memories. I don't have one negative memory now. It kind of like erases the bad stuff and keeps the good stuff. So, that's my opinion on Russo as a writer, as a person. I don't really know him, but seems like a good guy. He was always nice to me. He was never mean to me. He was never rude or anything like that. Just a difference of what I look for as a pro wrestling fan.
You've already referenced the final Nitro, but before that, I wanted to get your take on when you knew that, or when you first saw for real that the writing was on the wall and the company was in a great deal of jeopardy of going out of business. And were you one of some of the WCW people that I've had the pleasure to interview over the years that thought legitimately that there would be a restart under Fusion Media and Bischoff in, it was rumored to be in Las Vegas. Was that your understanding as well?
Yeah, the plan was for me to be John Laurinaitis was going to be Eric's right-hand man, already really was his go-to. And I was, at that point, John Laurinaitis' right-hand man. And so, you know, I'd like to think if that would have happened, you know, maybe I could have been an executive vice president 20 years, you know, down the road or something like that. But it didn't. I knew things were going to change when the Fusion thing happened. But up until 3 or 4 days before before the last night show, when they announced that Vince was buying the company and the TV rights weren't going to be renewed, I had no idea. And it's probably better that way because I would have been nuts if I would have known that was in the works. So not knowing that until like the Saturday before the last night show, and then I traveled on Sunday, did the night show and came back. So it really was a quick turnaround for me. But I knew that things were going to change when Fusion was on. I never in a million years thought that they would cancel the programming, even though it, I mean, it was still doing pretty decent ratings. I thought maybe they would dump Thunder, you know, and just keep Nitro. But yeah, you know, find out later on that, you know, once Turner lost his power, you know, once he went from 100% to 66 and a third, 2/3% to 33 and a third percent, everybody had already decided our fate. They didn't care if it was making money, losing money, and be losing money, but they didn't care. They were all embarrassed about wrestling. The only one that kept it alive was Ted Turner. And once he lost his power, it was gone.
Did you ever have an opportunity, David, or was there ever any discussions about you going to the WWE at any point?
Jim Ross and John Laurinaitis came to Atlanta a couple of weekends, and they met with everybody in like 15, 20-minute blocks in a ritzy hotel in Marietta. And I told that that the current plan was for WCW to be run as a separate brand. And if that was the case, if and when that was the case, they would like me to be the ring announcer if I was interested. I said, of course I'm interested. But obviously we all know that never happened. It never really went anywhere. They didn't have the talent, nothing against the talent who they got, but they didn't need all those guys that Vince didn't want to pick up because they were making millions and millions of dollars. They needed a couple of them. Like, you know, if they'd had a Sting and a Flair and a Booker T, or a Nash and a, you know, Sting and a Booker T, I think they could have done something with like two or three of the main guys. But you know, with what they had, and again, no disrespect towards anybody, a lot of them have gone on to become huge stars in this business and very successful behind the scenes. It just at the time they weren't, and so it just didn't happen.
So you moved on to Total Nonstop Action Wrestling after WCW folded and had quite a tenure there as well. Wanted to get your thoughts on a couple of things. One being, what were your impressions of the company? Did you think that, especially for that brief period of time, they appeared to be, you know, a viable contender for a number two promotion for the United States? And secondly, your famous story, if you could just do a Reader's Digest version of that Kurt Angle situation.
Yeah, before we get into that, just want to let people know, if they want to buy the book City Ringside Volume 1, 200 pages of bonus, never-before-seen content, including the last Nitro format and my story and take on the business. You could go to either Amazon.com or you could go to DavidPenzerBook.com. DavidPenzerBook.com. There's all kinds of bundles in there that give you extra access and extra things that aren't in the book. So go to DavidPenzerBook.com. It was really interesting going from WCW to TNA, because WCW, I was personally invested. This was living my dream. And if it went away, I didn't know what I was going to do. Well, in the meantime, I figured out what I was going to do. I started with a bunch of partners, too many in hindsight, a very successful airbrush tattoo company called Australian Airbrush Tattoos. I ran the company, and we're in over 100 theme parks, zoos, aquariums in North America, and over at one point almost 40 cruise ships. And so it was a very successful company. I didn't need wrestling anymore. And so it was very different, because while I rooted for TNA to be successful, I wasn't invested in it. And it gave me a lot more chance just to sit back and enjoy it. You know, I didn't have to worry about it. If you sent me home tomorrow, it was okay. I was only supposed to be there for a couple of weeks. Luckily, Jeremy Borash was so good at the backstage interviews. It lasted 4 years. You know, I didn't have that same psychological investment into it that I did with WCW. So it was really cool. There was no, you know, I wasn't worrying about anything. You know, Jeff, you know, let me do my job. If I had to, you know, hop on a conference call, you know, at 5 o'clock before the tapings with a company, you know, I could do that. He would give me like a little place to do that. So, and part part of that reason that the Kurt Angle thing happened, to segue, I was at a trade show in Orlando. We were taping in Orlando, obviously, at Universal, and we had a trade show. And so I didn't get there that night till like 5:30. So hindsight, I didn't know this, but Kurt, we didn't have a lot of time to go over it. And I didn't know this at the time, but Kurt was worried I wasn't going to know how to sell it. So he just decided to give me no choice. It's funny though. It's funny. You know, he was very apologetic, and we always, you know, I always joke with him about it. When I see him, and you know, he's always so sorry. I mean, really feels bad, but there's part of me that thinks that if the same thing happened tomorrow and he was afraid that I wasn't going to know how to sell it, he'd lay it in. Not me personally, anybody. That's just the way Kurt, that's the way his mind is built. I don't think he meant anything by it. He wasn't trying to hurt me. He was trying to get me to sell it. And he's stiff, you know, he was stiff even when he wasn't trying to get somebody to sell something. So that's just his style. He won a gold medal in the Olympics. We all know, I mean, his incredible, you know, some of the stuff that he did physically, you know, with all the stuff that had happened in his body is miraculous, quite frankly. No hard feelings. I got a $500 bonus and I got a night off. So, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. It wasn't permanent. You know, it all healed. And now it's a story I could go back and tell. At the time, I wasn't thrilled, but what do you do?
Yeah. What's your impressions now of obviously Impact switching back to, we'll say, the TNA name, and then under a wing of Endeavor? The future is looking kind of bright and stable for them, isn't it?
Yeah. Had a great crowd. First time in, I think, the history of professional wrestling, they had to turn the volume down. Yeah, it was fun to watch. I didn't watch the pay-per-view, but I watched the SmackDown, and that was fun to watch. I've never met Vince McMahon, but I know a lot of people who are close to him, and apparently he hated when the crowd took over the shows. He wanted to run the show, the crowd, not the crowd run the show. And so he would have lost his freaking mind probably that lesson if he was still there. But I thought it made for a really fun atmosphere, at least on the SmackDown that I saw. And they're doing great. You know, they made it clear it's the Paul Levesque era, and he's doing great. And, you know, I have a brief history of, you know, being on the road with him for about 3 months when he was terrorizing in WCW, and we didn't stay in touch or anything like that, but I got to see him break in, and glad that he's, you know, done so well in so many different facets and ways. And, you know, it's an exciting time in the business. There's a lot of companies, you know, TNA rebranded. They got incredible talent. The atmosphere behind the scenes is like a family. Wrestling's like a family, but more like a family than I've ever seen anywhere, not even close. It was a shame that Scott D'Amore didn't agree with something or whatever. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I mean, that was his passion. And I'm sure he'll do something when he's able to. I saw that he trademarked something apparently. So we'll see. But, you know, I've known Scott 30 years. I broke him in as an intimate guy in WCW. So, you know, we go back to when I was his boss, and things quickly turned on that in that realm. But yeah, you know, it's an exciting time for the wrestling business. You know, you got a lot of different people who are getting a lot of different companies and making money and, you know, getting TV ratings and TV deals. And, you know, that's fun, you know, because it took a long time. I mean, when WCW went away, it took a long time to get the television executives to have any interest in anything but WWF, WWE. You know, I was in the XWF right after WCW went out of business. And, you know, there was a reason that we didn't get on the air, even though we had incredible talent and production, all that. There was a reason why TNA started as a weekly pay-per-view and then had to pay to get on the air. When WCW dropped the program that was in the top 20 programs on cable television, i.e. Nitro, other executives started wondering, well, what do they know that we don't know? You know, because obviously it's not worth it. So it took a long time to get to where we are. And, you know, I wish everybody would just stop being divided and making sides and just enjoy all of it. Watch what you like. Don't watch what you don't like, but root for everybody. Because I was there when this business got changed, when one of the two national companies went out of business. And a lot of people starved and a lot of people didn't get to live their dream or were trying to make something of it on the indies, certainly not making the living they were making when you had two companies there. So, you can do what you want to do. I'm not going to judge you, but I would hope that people wouldn't root for the success or failure of anything. The success of the wrestling business should be what everybody wants to. And then you could watch what you think you like and don't watch what you don't like.
Yeah. What do you think, David, when you hear people make the comparison with AEW and WCW? What goes through your head when people say that? Because they're not alike at all, in my opinion, considering the heights that WCW reached. But people seem to think from outside the business that they know what's going on inside it. I'm just wondering what your thoughts is on that.
Look, from what I could see, WWE runs a more storyline company. They're into the storylines and the characters. AEW, for the most part, but not totally, they do care storylines, but they don't do as many of them. Tony seems to like more of the New Japan type level with dream matches, you know, matches one-on-one. Dream matches, you know, five-star matches. Look, my youngest son loves it. Never misses a pay-per-view, never misses a TV show. So, some people don't like it, and that's cool too. And, you know, look, Tony has the availability and the funding and to do whatever he wants, whatever he thinks is right. And, you know, whether it'll be successful or not is going to we'll have to, time will tell. But, he has every right to run his company the way he wants to run it. And if there's a lot of people that swear by it and watch it. My son is one of them. So, it's just two different. I think it's two different interpretations of professional wrestling. TNA is sort of a combination of both, more storylines, but also more, you know, dream matches and athletic matches. With X Division, yeah, I mean, I think that AEW is good for the business, and I think that Tony's probably having the time of his life. I've met him a few times, had a couple drinks with him, nice guy. It'll be interesting to see if his version of what he likes or thinks pro wrestling should be is something that is going to eventually grow an audience. But if he has the wherewithal to do it, then God bless him, and putting a lot of people, keeping a lot of families fed, and both production and talent. And he's offering an alternative to a product at a high level. So good for him.
Yeah, we're going to wrap it up now in a moment. I'm going to throw it over to Jack there for the last question. And David, if you just want to plug the book there again, we will have the links underneath this in the audio and video versions of this podcast.
Yeah, it's just David Penzer, City Ringside, Volume 1. We're on Volume 2 coming out in October. It's basically everything that happens after WCW through now. And we have some bonus content from the XWF and TNA and stuff like that. So we got another round bonus content and never-before-seen stuff. You could go to either Amazon.com or DavidPenzerBook.com. Both the book's the same price at both Amazon and DavidPenzerBook.com. It's both free shipping. It's just if you want to see the bundles that are available, where you could actually have, say, the last Nitro format, not in the book to read, but print it out. I keep saying that if I could make it to WrestleCon next year, one of these big, StarCast or whatever, I'd love to get the last match of the format of the last Nitro signed by both Sting and Ric Flair and hang it up in my office. That's a cool piece of history. So, you know, if somebody's looking to do stuff like that and get formats autographed and stuff, there's other options for you. But you could go either place if you just want to buy the book. It's free shipping in both places. I appreciate your time, by the way.
Thank you. But before we wrap it up, I wanted to ask you, after your first TNA run, you're out of the business 7 years or so, doing your successful other business ventures, including the one you touched on in real estate. And then you popped up and became a well-known presence on the Hannibal TV up here in Canada. Many fans remember your personal reminiscences and then the interviews that you did. And it was quite popular because the channel is, you know, the number one combat sports channel in Canada. And then I noticed last year you had some rather unflattering things to say about Devin Nicholson on Twitter. And I was just wondering what the origin of that was, because it never really got explained by yourself at the time.
I was going to do it, and then I was threatened legally, and I'm not going to put my family and my house and my everything at jeopardy over telling a story. So that will not be in volume two. Let's just say, to keep it short and sweet, that Devin was very good at pretending and acting like he was a good person. And ultimately, he's not a good person. And I'll leave it at that for legal reasons.
Okay. Fair enough. Morris, do you have any closing questions or comments for Mr. Penzer before we get the book plug one final time?
No, I'd just like to thank David. I know he's got another interview now in about 3 minutes, so we'll get him out of here. David, just one more time for the fans, just let it plug.
Yeah, davidpenzerbook.com, amazon.com. Check it out. Leave a review. Let me know what you think. Follow me on Twitter at David Penzer, all one word. It's pretty simple. And, you know, no politics, no arguments. We just talk about wrestling. I tell old stories and show old pictures and, you know, and my thoughts on the current product, and try to keep it as sane as you could keep anything on Twitter these days. So join me and let me know what you think of the book. I'm really interested. You know, so far it's been, you know, very well received, but, you know, I'm curious to hear what everybody thinks. It is my story. And, you know, so, you know, and just thank you for anybody that's ever, you know, listened to my podcast or been a fan. You know, I got to live with him for 30 years and not many people say that at a high level. And I'm grateful for that. And, you know, I could have used grateful as the book's title, but Eric stole it from me. He got it first. But yeah, I'm grateful and humbled. And you know, if you had any part in that journey, I thank you. I appreciate it. And if you want to read about it, you know where to go. And I thank you guys for your time. Sorry, I have to run. I got more of these things tonight.
No problem, man. Best of luck.
Okay, thank you.
So on behalf of Morris and myself, want to thank Mr. Penzer once again for his time tonight. And fans, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the channel and like this video, and we will see you next time. Thank you for watching, everybody.